He will carry you through.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we've forgiven our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. This concludes our study tonight of the sermon or the prayer included in the Sermon on the Mount. It's usually called the Lord's Prayer. It's the prayer that he taught his disciples. It's very comprehensive in its scope. It's very instructive in its content. And it's varied, and yet it's unified. It centers around the heart of the kingdom. And if we will master the petitions in this prayer, I'm confident that our lives as Christians will be richly blessed. And like the thoughts in the Beatitudes, the thoughts in these petitions of the Lord's Prayer are so to the point and so to the heart of the matter of Christianity that we cannot pray this prayer sincerely without being a better person and without being a surrendered person to the Lordship of Jesus Christ. Charles Spurgeon observed that this prayer, each one of the petitions of which place us in a particular relationship with God. And he makes some beautiful observations. I'm going to give them to you just briefly in passing by way of introduction. Our Father who art in heaven, he says, this pictures us as children away from home. Hallowed be thy name, pictures us as worshipers. Thy kingdom come as subjects. Thy will be done as servants. Give us this day our daily bread as beggars. Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors, pictures us as sinners. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil, as sinners who stand in danger of becoming greater sinners still, and who stand in need of constant deliverance and guidance. It's been observed that this prayer is like a ladder. It doesn't begin like the Beatitudes at the bottom and go to the top. The prayer begins at the top and goes to the bottom. It allows us to approach God first as a child of God and then last as a sinner. The Beatitudes, which talk of the reality of coming into the kingdom, talk about us being sinners first, and then it develops to the top to where we enjoy the fullness of the kingdom. But when we come before God in prayer, Jesus allows us to come there, and God allows us to come there as a child of God first, regardless, and then as a sinner of before God at last, inevitably, but nevertheless, a child first and a sinner last. There's so many things I would like to say about this subject. There's so many things that ought to be said, and yet I'm going to have to narrow it down. Brother Burke, I'm going to have to bale my hay tonight. You mentioned this morning that you were going to bale your hay for next Sunday. He had so much material he didn't quite know how to what to do with it. He said, I'm going to bale my hay for next Sunday. I've got mine baled tonight. I have a feeling I should have sorted it before I baled it is the only problem. Because this subject is very wide in its scope, and there's so much to be said about it, I'm going to limit it to that kind of temptation that deals with evil. I'm going to limit it to the sources of it and try to explain and define for us the sources of the evil temptations. There are a lot of trials and tests that we undergo by the design of God for the polishing of our characters. And sometimes these overlap, and I don't know how to define or differentiate. So I'm going to just simply try to take one of the group, one of these two aside, and look at it briefly, and we'll notice some of the others at another time. The word lead us not into temptation. The word temptation is the word perosmos, which means the test or the trial. It's a very interesting word. We got our word experience from it. Ex perosmos, the one who has come through or come out of the trial. And we say that that man has experience or that person has experience. It means they've gone through the trial and they've come out of it. I think we would get our word expert. Is that not right from the same word? The one who has come through it, he knows what he's talking about. Someone said to me as I was preaching on temptation some months ago, they were chiding me and saying, well, it's good to be able to speak on a subject in which you have great experience of temptation. Well, I laughed and took it as a good-natured joke. He didn't realize what he was saying. It was a compliment, really. James says, count it all joy when you fall into manifold temptations or trials, knowing that the proving of your faith works steadfastness, and let steadfastness have its perfect work, that you might be perfect and entire, lacking in nothing. But I think it's appropriate at this time that we study this subject because of the fact that we're going to be splitting up shortly. You're going to be going home, many of you, to your homes, your former backgrounds, your former circumstances. You're going to need to pray this prayer, lead me not into temptation. For invariably that you're going to come back and many of you will have been unmindful and you will have been heedless and slothful in your approach to your former manner of life, and you're going to be going back into it if you're not careful. Pray this prayer sincerely, and God will help you watch for those doors of escape. The rest of us who are going to be here left in the community, we're going to be fighting our battle here, so it's appropriate for us here. And then it's going to be appropriate when those of you who have departed return, because you're going to be then fighting the battles that are here in this community. You're going to have to be fighting the temptation, and you're going to have to decide moral issues, whether you're going to cheat, whether you're going to be promiscuous, whether you're going to be licentious, whether you're going to be loose in your morals, whether you'll lie, whether you're going to be foul-mouthed. All of these things, you see, they require a decision to be made. And I want us tonight to see if we can't decide where these temptations come from and what we can do about escaping them. Lead us not into temptation, I think, implies that there has been a change of direction in our lives. I think it recognizes the fact that there's been a change in me, Lord, and I don't want to go back like I used to be. Oh, how many times have I prayed and have you prayed, Lord, don't let me go back like I was. How many times have I prayed, Lord, lift me on higher ground than I've ever lived before. Don't let me be overcome by myself. How many times have I prayed, Lord, save me from myself. That's what this prayer, I think, here is about. That we might not live any longer in the flesh like the Gentiles live, doing the things that the writer of Simon Peter said, doing the things that the Gentiles like to do. But he said, let the time pass suffice for having lived like that. And he said, you live a different kind of life. Paul told the Romans that we ought to reckon ourselves dead to sin and alive to God. This prayer is a prayer prayed by someone in whose life there's been made a change of course, and he's been given a different direction. And it's a prayer of confidence that God is leading us. It's the prayer that David prayed when he said, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He leads me in paths of righteousness. God is our leader. Paul confidently expressed in 2 Corinthians 1 and verse 10 that he has delivered me and he will deliver me, on whom I have placed my hope, that he will deliver me yet again. Paul had the confidence that God was leading, not into temptation, but that he would deliver us out of or from the evil one. So we're faced with this problem of temptation. You're faced with it. I'm faced with it. There's not a one of us here tonight who is of the age of accountability that's not faced with the subject of temptation. I want to ask you the question then, what are the sources of these temptations? You know, this monkey that's on your back, where'd he come from? And we'll study in just a minute, how do you get rid of him? But where does he come from? I'd like to know where this monkey on my back, this thing of temptation, comes from. What are the sources of temptation? Eve felt that the source of the temptation and her sin was Satan. She said, Satan gave me the fruit and I ate it. Flip Wilson feels the same way. The devil made me do it. Everything that he did, or Geraldine, it's always the devil made me do it. I suspect that both Eve and Flip are overlooking one of the basic factors in sin, And they're looking merely at the instrumentality or the instrument by which this temptation was brought to bear upon them, or perhaps the instrument by which the temptation, which already existed in the character of the person, was made to be perhaps unbearable, it seems, and they succumbed to it. But they're blaming both of them blaming the thing upon Satan, when probably there are some other things involved. It's complicated. I don't know whether I can sort it out. I think I struggle with this one thing, both in the thing itself and then trying to describe the nature of it as much as any other subject that we've studied in this series on the Lord's Prayer. It's complicated in the sense that the same temptation for some people produces one reaction, and in another person it produces another reaction. So, and I'll draw a conclusion. Let me give you an illustration first of this. From Saigon on March the 23rd, 1967, there came a news report that there were soldiers jailed for rape and murder. Four American soldiers were jailed last night for the rape and murder of a Vietnamese girl they picked up while on patrol in the Central Highlands. A pathologist said the victim was assaulted repeatedly, stabbed three times and shot twice in the back of the head. The soldiers, all of whom received dishonorable discharges, received jail terms ranging from 8 years to life imprisonment. The four were tried separately and convicted mainly on the evidence of Private Robert Storby, age 22, a fifth member of the patrol who refused to become involved in the crime. Storby testified that the others picked up the girl on November the 17th and took her to an abandoned hut. They took turns entering the hut, he testified. Storby said that he was ordered to have intercourse with her before the 5 days was up, or else he would find himself killed in action. He later guided a search party to the hut where the girl's body was found, her hands tied behind her back. Now here were five young men faced with the same temptation. Four of them did something, the other one did something else. Four of them surrendered to it, and the other one did not surrender, but it was the same temptation. It was the same subject, the same issue, which drives me to the conclusion that one of the basic sources of our temptation must be the weaknesses and the imperfections in our own character. I don't see how I can get around the fact that it must lie within our own weaknesses and our own imperfections, and the temptations are basically at least one of the sources is our own imperfection and our own lack of something in our character that causes us to be susceptible to these things. James says every man or every person is tempted when he is seduced and led astray by his own passion. And the passion, when it has conceived, gives birth to sin. And the sin, when it's full grown, brings forth death. So you have this progression. Each one of us is led astray or is seduced by his own passion. And the passion, then, when it is conceived, gives birth to sin. And the sin, when it's full grown, brings death. But you see, James puts it here. It lies within you to a great extent. You're led astray by your own passion. And these passions and these weaknesses of character come about, I'm convinced, many times because of some lack in your upbringing as a child. Now, I'm not here to justify sin or to excuse the sinner. And I'm not here to try to sort out all the environmental influences and their relationship to sin in your life. But I do know that there are things that you and I all lack in our character due to imperfections in the way we were brought up. And as a result, we all stand susceptible. We all stand open to sin, to one sin or another, to one degree or another, simply because of the fact that we live in a sinful world. We live having been brought up by imperfect parents. We live in just simply a sinful environment. For example, children who are brought up in a home where there's no love have a multiplicity of temptations that other children who are brought up and nourished in the love of God never understand, and they never are victims of. A child who is brought up without a loving father or is brought up without a loving mother has peculiar trials and tribulations and temptations that others of us don't have. A daughter who is raised in a home where there's hate and envy and jealousy and wrangling and fighting, that girl is tempted to marry the first no-count so-and-so that comes by that'll marry her just to get out of the problems of her own home. And so her whole life, you see, she's tempted, and I look at that as a temptation. She's tempted to escape. She's tempted to do something. Many times it's even wrong. Sometimes the man is a divorcee. Sometimes he's just simply worthless. And yet, because he offers her an escape route from her home, she's tempted to marry him and ruin her life. Children who are brought up without a sense of accomplishment, or who are brought up without any sense of what you would call approval, those children are tempted to lie and exaggerate to get approval. And I've seen them, I've counseled with them. And you have too, probably, and many of you who counsel. They lack this quality of having developed a self-image that's worthy and that's acceptable. And consequently, because their parents did not give them this approval and let them have this self-image of being all right, they find themselves having many times to lie and to exaggerate in order to get the approval of their peers. Young ladies many times find themselves doing this to the extent that not only do they lie and exaggerate for approval, but they began using their bodies. They began allowing themselves to be used by men. You know why? Not because of any love. They do it to get something that has been deprived them. They do it to get the approval of other people. And thus they are laid open to these temptations that other people don't find themselves susceptible to. A lack of security in a child's life may very well mean that he will grow up to be a covetous person, tight-fisted, and one who is afraid to let anybody get to him, you know, at all. And he wouldn't allow himself to give to anybody or to do anything for anybody for fear he'll be taken advantage of. And he grows up to be a real veritable Scrooge. Well, see, people who've been showered with love and affection and security and all, they're not susceptible to all these things. Now, I'm not saying this to excuse anybody, and I don't know what your particular sin is. I don't know what your particular weakness is. But I do say this, that there are going to be a lot of parents. In fact, there's going to be a whole slew of parents in the day of judgment who will stand there responsible for things that their children have done merely because of the fact that they failed their responsibility as a parent. And that's a very sobering thought. If you don't want to raise your children right, for goodness sakes, don't have them. Remain single or remain as a single or as a, don't go into parenthood if you don't want to raise your children. How do you say it? Remain childless if you don't want children, if you don't want the responsibility of them. But these things, I'm sure, have something to do with our being open to temptation. You're still responsible for yourself. What your past, all it does is explain why you're the way you are. What you do from this point on is still your responsibility. When Cain sinned against God in this thing of the sacrifice that he offered, and God didn't accept it. And Cain was all down in the mouth, and he was angry, and God said, Cain, why are you angry? If you do well, will you not be accepted? But if you do not well, sin couches at the door, and its desire is for you, but you'll have to rule over it. You'll have to overcome it. You'll have to master it, the Revised Standard says. So it's your responsibility to master whatever flaw there has been in your character because of the failure of someone who maybe raised you or failed to raise you properly. But you're the one responsible for it, nevertheless. But all right, that's one thing. What has happened in our past may have left us open to temptations and trials that other people are not open to. But a second thing that we are all guilty of, and that is the sheer heedlessness that characterizes the lives of many of us. Having come to understand ourselves as we are, many times we then set ourselves up in a position that we are not fortified to occupy, and we full well know it. Perhaps you're a lustful person, and yet you'll put yourself in a position that you know full well is literally flirting with danger. You'll go on a date by yourself, or you'll occupy a position that you know you cannot possibly occupy and come out without being scorched or singed or burned. Those of you who are covetous, you'll put yourself in a position where you'll almost invariably find yourself stealing. Those of you who want good grades and who find yourself having been tempted in the past to cheat, you're going to find yourself cheating now if you have the opportunity. These things, I say, we keep setting ourselves up, and I see people do it every week. I counsel people every week, and so does Terry, every week. And he and I have found that we use this same expression, you're setting yourself up. Can't you see that? We find ourselves then doing this And you know, some people say, well, I'm just naive. Well, I've told people for some years now, naivete is possible in the first encounter. But after the second or third or fourth, you know, you're no longer naive. I tell people, no, you're not naive, you're stupid. That's your problem. You're just plain stupid to put yourself in that position over and over and over, knowing your circumstances, knowing what you're made of, knowing your weaknesses, to put yourself in a constant temptation like that and do it knowingly. That's not naivete, that's just plain stupidity. And so as a result, life patterns that have established themselves over the years because of our continuing to give in to sin, those life patterns then set us up for another temptation. If you've sprained your ankle, you know how much easier it is to sprain it again. And you sprain that ankle again, and it's just terribly easy to sprain it again. That's the same way it is with the way we set ourselves up for sin. If you know that you have a weak ankle, then you favor it, and you don't go into those situations where you're likely to sprain it again. If you know you have a weakness in your character, you don't keep on flirting with sin. You stay away from it, and you keep trying then to have victory after victory in order to strengthen yourself, but you don't keep setting yourself up. Then there's a third thing. Things that have happened to us in our past life, no doubt they contribute. That's number one. Second, those continual reoccurring temptations that we allow ourselves to surrender or submit to, they keep us in a weakened condition to where we're more and more susceptible to them. But then third, let me read a quotation. I keep this under my desk glass, on my desk in front of me every day. The temptations of life do not get weaker as one gets older. And I keep reminding myself of this every day. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, the pride of life, your battle with them will get fiercer as you get older. Our prayer should be, keep me from secret faults, deliver me from presumptuous sins. An old man's heart is the devil's busiest workshop. Watch your step then, watch your heart then, as you get older day by day. Shut the door of your life, close your eyes, let no wrong imagination dwell ever in your heart. It is these things that tell on a minister's life and mar his work. You want to ruin your life? Then you let these plants grow up in your life, these weeds of sinfulness, these weeds of temptation and all. Let them grow up in the crevices and cracks of your life. Don't think they're going to get less strong as you get older. They're going to get fiercer and fiercer and fiercer. The only thing is that you become less able to satisfy your temptations. So he says, watch your heart, keep yourself. The older you get, the fiercer become the temptations. That simply, and these three things, simply talk about our own weaknesses, our own failures and our faults, our flaws of character. These things must contribute to our temptation. But there's another thing, and that's the second source, and that is this invisible enemy that you and I have, this malignant one who is always engaged in malignant activity, our supernatural foe, the adversary, the one who is forever tempting us and who delights in our destroying or in our destruction, who delights in destroying us. He's called the evil one. Jesus refers to him here either personally or impersonally as he talks about the tu poneru, the one who is evil, and deliver us from him that is evil or deliver us from evil. John talks about him in 1 John 2:14 when he talked about how those young men had overcome the evil one. He's described in the Bible as the enemy of all righteousness. Peter describes him as a roaring lion roaming around or roving around seeking whom he may devour. Simon Peter describes him like that. Paul describes him in the book of, where is it? Where Paul describes him as, Brother Burke had a blackout. Paul describes him as an angel of light, disguising himself as an angel of light. Peter's a roaring lion, very visible. Paul, as one who is disguised by something that makes him look like an angel of light. Jesus called Satan and his workers, these false teachers, as wolves in sheep's clothing. And on you can go into the book of Revelation. He's called a dragon and a serpent in the book of Genesis. And all through, he's called these various things that show us the multiplicity of the way that he gets into us. And his wiles His subtle graces, and I say graces, his subtle ways of getting into us, they're not graces, they're wiles, Paul calls them. And he has a multiplicity of them. They all center in one of these three areas, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, and the vain pride or glory of life. These are mentioned by John in 1 John 2. They're also found in the temptation of Jesus in Matthew, the 4th chapter, where Satan tempted him in these very three ways, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, and the pride of life. And Satan gets to you like that, and you might as well be expecting him. We're living in an age, however, when that's not enough. Satan now has become the electronic manipulator. Do you know that it's possible for people in preparation of films to appeal to your subliminal impulses that you don't even know they're tampering with? In the book by Francis Schaeffer, he talks about these, what he calls the manipulators, the electronic manipulators. Preparing a film, they can put in one or two of these frames every so often where you don't even see them. Your eye doesn't pick it up. Your subliminal parts of your brain and all, it records this, what they call a subliminal impulse. And they tested it out by just simply putting up on there popcorn. And you don't see it with your naked eye, but you get it up here anyway in your subconscious, popcorn. And they tested it out on an audience, and the sale of popcorn during that one brief showing jumped 49%, I think. Just simply, and you didn't even know what had happened to you. And we laugh at that because, you know, popcorn, well, that's a very simple thing, not anything wrong in that. But how do you know? You see, if we're subject to this, and if Satan uses it, and don't put it past him, there are forces at work in America today that are literally destroying the various foundations of this nation. And they'll not be below stooping or not be above stooping to any method or means to do it. So we find these wiles of the devil. This is the other source of the temptations that confront us today. Those things that are within us, our own weaknesses, and then the external influence of Satan as he makes his attempt to destroy us, and he's out to get us. Jesus says he doesn't have anything on me. I'm not scared of him. I hate his guts, but I'm not scared of him. My Lord is stronger than he is, and I'm keeping my eye on the Lord. I'll mention that in just a moment. But what's the relationship between the two? I don't know. We may not ever know the full influence or the full relationship between the two. We may never know the full influence of Satan on us. We may never know the relationship between these two sources. But I think it can be illustrated. We know that sin's seat is in the will of man and woman. That's where the seat of sin is. It's in your will. It's in your will becoming obedient to the will of Satan. Righteousness is in your will becoming obedient to the will of God. Paul talked about it in Romans, the 6th chapter, when he says, do you not know that if you yield yourselves to anyone as obedient slaves, you're the slaves of the one whom you obey, either of sin, which leads to death, or of obedience, which leads to righteousness. So you see, here are the two alternatives. But sin comes from yielding to temptation, yielding your members as instruments of unrighteousness, which leads to death. That's what he's talking about. But the point is that it's at your will point, down in where your will is, that's where the seat of sin is. And your will can be influenced by outside influence. Your will has been influenced, I hope, by the will of God over the years. Your will at times is influenced by my will. My will at times is influenced by your will. And we find ourselves then being influenced by outside influences, and my will being brought into under the influence of someone else's will. And I think it can be illustrated by this thing of hypnotism. Have you ever been hypnotized? How many of you have ever been hypnotized? Any of you? Let me see your hands if you've been hypnotized. All right, I've tried, but they say you've got to have something to work with. They never did have any luck with me. But you know, they say the more you're hypnotized, the more susceptible you are to it. The more you yield your will to someone else's will, the more bendable it is. And the more you're hypnotized, and a man that hypnotizes a person, and I've had people tell me that, you know, the first time it was kind of difficult, but then they went back, and the more he did it, the more they were yielding to it. And incidentally, he could just get where he would snap his finger and the person would be gone. He'd be under the power of it. And he could snap his finger and bring him out. So he became literally and totally in subjection to the will of the hypnotist. Now, that's where I think the danger lies in continually yielding to the impulses of Satan, continually yielding to the temptations that Satan brings to bear against us. The more you yield, the more likely you are to yield, and the more susceptible you come to that power and that influence in your life. And thus we see that constantly yielding to temptation opens you to further temptation, until finally, at the snap of his finger, you're gone. And that's about the way many of us are. He just simply snaps his finger. If it's in clothing or if it's in music or whatever it is, all Satan has to do is just snap his finger and off we go. It just really doesn't matter. Don't let it happen. The time is going to have to come when you simply stand up and say, that's all, and I'm not going to do it anymore. And only in Jesus Christ can you do that. How do you escape? Well, you look to Jesus Christ. I'm confident that any overmuch emphasis upon Satan as our adversary is wrong. I think it's bad. I've never seen many runners who could win a race by looking over their shoulder. Have you? Paul says, or the Hebrew writer says, let us run with patience the race that's set before us, looking to Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. He's out there. That's the way our race is to be run. Don't spend a lot of time looking over your shoulder at Satan. He's back there, but don't worry about him. Put your eye on the Lord. That's where the solution is. In Matthew, the 4th chapter, the first 11 verses, we find out how he did it. Now, I've spoken on that before, and I think you've gotten the lesson. He did it by keeping his mind primed with the Word of God and filled with the consciousness and the awareness of the presence of God. It is written, it is written, it is written, he says. And all three it is written's contain God. Thou shalt worship the Lord thy God. Thou shalt live, a man doesn't live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. And thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God. These were the ways that Jesus Christ overcame sin. And then Paul tells us how. In 2 Corinthians, the 10th chapter, and verse 5, it's a passage that I've taken as a lodestone, I think they call it. This is what I have hanging in my office constantly, right to my left hand. It's visible at my desk as I type and as I study this thought. Every thought captive to obey Jesus Christ. That's the way to overcome temptation. Keep your mind on the Lord. And then Paul said that, remember this, he said, that no temptation has overtaken you, but such as is common to man, and that God will not allow us to be tempted above what we're able, but will with the temptation provide also the way of escape that we may be able to endure it. So if you're being tempted, pray God, pray this prayer, Father, lead me not into temptation, but deliver me from evil. I think it's a parallelism again. He's saying, don't lead me into temptation where it'll destroy me, but deliver me out of this evil. And if I must be brought into it, then bring me out of it. Don't let me drown. Brother Warren told me last week, he said that he almost drowned once, and his prayer, as he prays this prayer, has to do with this feeling that he has about water. He says, I pray, Lord, don't let that happen to me again. I almost drowned. Don't let me get that close again. Keep me up. Fortify me. Be my rock. Be my shield. Today, you're fighting with temptation. You're wrestling with it. How are you coming? Are you yielding yourself, or are you yielding yourself to Satan? Are you yielding to God or yielding to Satan? I maintain that the more you yield to Satan, the more susceptible you'll be to temptation. But with every victory, you'll gain, as the song says, the victory will give you the strength for the next victory and the next trial or temptation. This prayer is a prayer for surrender. This prayer is a prayer for leadership. It's a prayer for guidance. It's a prayer confessing weakness and need. And God would have you be there, for he'll always bear you up. As Paul said to the Corinthians, he delivered me, and he will deliver me, on whom I have put my hope that he will deliver me again. And he'll do that for you. Put your confidence in the Lord. Look to Jesus running your race. Don't look to Satan. Hate him and get rid of him. Cleave to that which is good. Resist him and he'll flee from you. These are all things you could go on all night long just talking about all the Bible says about how to overcome evil and sin and temptation. It's for your good that you overcome it. It will destroy you if you don't resist it. May God bless us. If you're here tonight and you're having trouble with sin and you need to make some clean break with it, and people here know you've been living in sin, come publicly and do it. If it's something that you struggle with privately and you have to pray, "Oh Lord, search my heart, know my ways, and see if there's any, or try me and know my ways, and see if there's any evil way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." If this may be your need, or if you're not a Christian, and you want to get out of the realm of the devil, get out of where he is, then come into Jesus Christ, and then claim the grace and the mercy that's in Jesus Christ as our faithful high priest. It's all for you, and it's available. If you're tired of living in sin, get out of it and pray that God will lead you not into temptation, but will deliver you from evil. May God bless you. If you want to come and respond, come in faith, turning your back upon sin, and be baptized into Jesus Christ for the remission of those sins, and then claim him as your deliverer. He's waiting for you, and he invites you to come while we stand and sing.
One plea, but that thy blood.